In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. Tonight we come to a reflection upon the last two in our list of the capital sins, that of gluttony and of sloth. Now, don't think just because I mention them at the end, you know, at the end of Lent, that by some means we're supposed to look at it and say, well, this is because they're not as important or as worrisome or whatever else you want to look at it that particular way. Every capital sin is worrisome. That I mention them toward the end here has nothing to do with importance or not over things, because I was trying in the course of our Lenten time of reflection on the Ten Commandments of God and on the commandments of the Church to also try to pair up where it could the reflection upon the capital sins and the vices that were there. So it left to us gluttony and sloth, which weren't necessarily covered, you know, directly by the Ten Commandments of God nor of the Church. And we've come to the last week of Lent, so we have to put the two here together. One thing we need to understand about these two, of gluttony and of sloth, that these are sins that proceed directly from sensuality. We talked about sensuality before in the sixth and ninth commandments. To some degree, in the fifth commandment, we let the senses go too wild. Somewhat, again, in the same seventh and tenth, we let our senses look at the property and things of others and covet them and steal them and things like that. We let our senses go wrong at that particular point. In this area here, when we talk about how they proceed from sensuality, I think as we go through it, you'll see how the vice of gluttony and that of sloth. I'm going to say sloth. Some people pronounce it sloth. You know, I don't know that there is a real right way to pronounce it, sloth or sloth. But it's just for years I've been taught to me and pronounced that particular way. So I just want to get that out of the way in case that's a big distraction for some people. But these two particular sins here, the sensuality that they have, either proceeding from sensuality or senses that are run amok, or by giving into them, it weakens that sensuality, which can cause us all kinds of problems with sins that come up. And we'll see that as we review these various points that take place. So the first one I want to review tonight is that of gluttony. According to the Catechism and what the spiritual writers tell us about this capital sin, that it's an abuse of legitimate pleasure God has attached to eating, drinking, and the necessary means of self-preservation. Many, many spiritual writers have said if God did not attach pleasure to certain actions, we wouldn't do them. And when it comes to that part of eating, we more than likely would not if there was not some kind of a pleasure attached to it. It doesn't mean it's a sinful pleasure. It only gets sinful when it gets way out of hand or the word that is used is inordinate. If we're eating and drinking for our own sakes, when there's no need, or born beyond the need, or attached to these little intricate type little delicacies right there, and we won't eat anything if it isn't that little delicacy. It has to be made of these kind of things that came from this land, cultivated by this little bug, and all these particular things there, and now I've got, that's the only food I'm going to eat. If it isn't that way, then not going to have it. That's gluttony. You think, wait, we're not overeating. No, but you're over-concerned about the food and the things that are there and that particular part here, or daintily prepared foods. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not encouraging people, wives who cook for their husbands or for their family, other people who cook on their own, whatever you might do, that what I'm saying here, Father said, not to be daintily prepared foods. I'm just going to slam a bunch of things together in this pot and pour it out on the plate and say, there, it's food, eat it. No, that's not what I mean. You know, the part of the pleasure of the food is the looking at it, too, the way it's presented. But where it's so daintily prepared at that particular point, that's where we get into trouble. The malice of the vice of gluttony, first of all, it makes the soul a slave to the body. The soul wants to be able to rise up to God. The soul wants to be able in all things there to turn toward God in everything, with all the things that our senses bring into the soul to help to know and to love God better and better. But gluttony has a way of enslaving the body. It brutalizes man, makes him like a brute, like an animal. That's what we mean by brutalizes man. gives him that animal-type quality where it weakens his intellectual and his moral life. It paves the way to lustful desires. And it's a mortal sin when done for a considerable period of time. Well, we don't care. We're weakening ourselves in these particular points. And because of this, lustful desires come up. Because of this, anger comes up. Because of this, we become slothful. Whatever. Then it can be mortally sinful. You see, sloth incapacitates our lives, children of God. Incapacitates us. Makes us so we don't function as children of God like we should. Now, gluttony is venial if one fails in this way, but without grave excess. You don't eat, so let's say someone eats too much at a celebration or to please a friend. It's not something that goes on all the time. However, it's something that did take place. And it wasn't the word is moderation and mortification of self that needs to take place in those things. In the area of striving for perfection and for holiness, gluttony causes all other kinds of problems too. It weakens the will, and it helps us develop a love for sensual pleasure. Here we come up with the things of the sixth and ninth commandments, the capital sin of lust, and so many other things like that. Because of the way it dulls the senses, dulls the spiritual part of us, then the only other thing to go after that is the sensual way. You know, look over history. When we hear about like Henry VIII or Herod the Great or other people like that, the ones that gave in to sensuality greatly in their lives. We hear about it in history. We read about it. We see pictures of the movies depict these men for what they are. And for all of these people, with all their trouble, the reason why they're in trouble is because they have given in to gluttony. It has weakened their will. They've sought sensuality and so many different other things in food. And so now it opens the door to sensuality in thought. It becomes a source of many other faults that come up with people. Even the area, I would say, about improper jokes or dissipation. Dissipation is I'm not concentrating on God like I should. My mind is floating all over the place, especially in time of prayer. Gluttony can be the great cause for all of these things. The Catechism and spiritual writers all say that remedies against gluttony are, first of all, to practice mortification. Mortification means that I want to die to myself. I'm ready to, instead of drinking this and this and this, I'll have water. Or if I'm so attached to water, maybe I'll have tea or something of that particular nature. Something to mortify myself in the way that I eat. So that it's a sacrifice that I perform, and it's that sacrifice that actually builds up within me the strength of heart and soul that I need. We're keeping the body in check when we do that. You know, read the story of St. Francis of Assisi, how he talked about brother body and what he was doing to keep it in check. He always complained, brother body wants to do this, brother body wants to do that. But I'm trying to tell brother body, don't do that. Because you're giving into things that will take us away from the good, strong self, the strength of will that we need. And we'll find ourselves giving into temptation and sin. So St. Francis of Assisi, as many of the saints all show to us, practiced the spirit of mortification. It's the very thing that Our Lady of Fatima inspired in the children. Was a spirit of mortification that largely came about in the food that they ate. So they could keep their mind focused upon God and practice sacrifices in every way. Beyond this and other remedies, we need to be pleased with simple fare. It's not to say from time to time you can't have something that's more luxurious or something that's a bigger celebration or whatever it might be. But be pleased with the simple things. The food that is presented, how it is presented. Be pleased with what you get. That's often hard. But if someone takes time to prepare from food and think, well, it doesn't look quite as what I'd like, or it's not what I expected for today, or whatever. Oh, it's spaghetti again. Be pleased with what you get. If you develop that pleasure in what you get, then again, you're starting to show this is a remedy against giving into gluttony. All of this sums up with the whole idea of moderation in food and drink. Gluttony doesn't apply only to, you know, food. It's also to use of alcohol or other types of drink that's out there, that we become excessive in the use of that particular drink to the point that we can't survive without that. Not here talking about people I hear constantly, I can't survive without my morning coffee. Boy, don't get me up too early, Father, without having that cup, at least one cup of coffee to get going, then maybe I can get another one later on down the road. That's not necessarily what I mean, you know, at that particular point in that area. But, you know, if a day goes by and you can't get that morning cup of coffee in the beginning of the day, then offer it up. There's moderation at that particular point. And God will provide the time later on in the day for that. Some spiritual writers tell us that there are signs of progress, that if we have a weakness in the area of gluttony, there are signs of progress what we can do here. First of all, that we are pleased to have smaller portions and even less attractive portions. Okay, again, Boaz is telling us we should put things out with mold and stuff like that, so it's ugly looking. No. But you know these food cooking shows where they have to dress it all up and get everything right so they can win some things. And they get points taken off if everything isn't just right. They wipe the plate down and do all of these particular things with it. It's that area, you know. We never want to be slobbish in what things that we do. But however, just because it may not look good, a plate of spaghetti that's out there, hot dog, someone cooks a steak and it doesn't have all the burn marks on it that we need, the crisscross little signs there. I'm not sure if I want to eat it because those little crisscross marks are on there like they should have been. Sorry. That's not what we're looking to. That's what I was saying. Just be pleased with what you get. You're making progress against gluttony when you have less difficulty of eating between meals. You're understanding about mortification, keeping the body in check. There are some people with certain blood diseases or things like that, they're going to have to eat at certain times. But even in those points, keep it within moderation. Don't use it as an excuse to take it. One of the spiritual writers, when talking about gluttony, show we're having sign of progress in it, is that we're not taking our food with avidity. Avidity, one of those spiritual terms, like concupiscence. It's like a few other spiritual words that are out. We're going to get to another one later on, achidia. But avidity, that means we have so much focus on that food, we're just shoveling it in. That's it. We don't pay attention to people or things around us. It's just coming in, just as much as we can, as quickly as we can, and roar, I'm done. That's avidity. And that shows the beastliness of us. When we eat less in that way, then we're making progress. And even when it comes to it, is that we move to take a little more of what we dislike in the food that's there. St. Therese of Lisieux makes a particular point about this in a spirit of moderation and penance that she wanted to perform. In the religious life, you're supposed to eat what you set in front of you. And that's what's there, not to complain about it, because that's what poverty demands. However, it doesn't dictate how much you have or if you can pass it up in charity to my neighbor, my sister, my brother there who didn't get any, so I'll just pass it over at this particular point. In reality, I should have taken it because it's a food that I dislike and I really need to get on top of things. Anyway, she brings up that particular point that she had so conquered self that some of the other sisters around her were trying to figure out at mealtime what food she didn't like. They couldn't tell. Oh, there were many types of food that she did not like. But she accepted it as a pact of mortification from Almighty God and something to keep and to live her vow of poverty and things of that nature. And so they couldn't discover that at that particular point. Just one more thing of that little way of St. Therese of Lisieux that is so important. Now we look at the capital sin of sloth. Here's a quote from somebody about sloth. It's a good explanation of it, a good starting explanation of it. Sloth is a sin that believes in nothing, cares for nothing, seeks to know nothing, interferes with nothing, enjoys nothing, hates nothing, finds purpose in nothing, lives for nothing, and remains alive because there's nothing else to do, or else they would die. Nothing. That's the whole point. Sloth can masquerade itself with tolerance. I'm not doing anything here right now because I'm just tolerating what this person is doing. I'm tolerating this kind of work that has to be done. And so I'm just being patient. You're being tricked there. You know, a slothful person can also be busy. Think of that. But busy about nothing. You know, we use the slang type of expression today about spinning your wheels. It's the idea of there's a car, you see people with it, just smoke coming out the tires, and it's not moving. And that's a slothful person. They can be busy, but the activity leads to nowhere. All they're doing is marking time in a life that has no ultimate purpose. That's why I often think, you know, there's two animals that I think of when I think of sloth. There's one, there's a bear out there, it's called a sloth bear. Have you ever seen pictures of it? If you haven't, go, if you have a computer, go Google it and look up the sloth bear. They're ugly looking, big nose, shaggy hair, they just kind of all mange around and do things like this. Most of the pictures I see of sloth bears just show them how they're just lazy. You wonder how they eat and survive. They do, but they're not very productive as far as the animals go. And the other animal I often think of when I think about sloth is Eeyore in, you know, the Winnie the Pooh stuff. Oh, bother. Now he walks around and does things like this. Don't tell me to do anything too fast. This is getting bothersome. Perfect. Perfect example of sloth. And far too many of our people are like Eeyore in many, many ways in their life. Most people who are guilty of sloth can end up in despair. That hopelessness. It's distinct from clinical depression. It's not necessarily depression that needs medical attention. This is just despair and saying, I'm too weak. I can't work for anything. I'll never make it to heaven. It's going to be too hard. God knows I can't do it. And on and on and on and on the words come. Back in the 1400s or 1500s, there was one of the saints. I tried to look up his name. I can't remember. But he was religious. And he was preaching to other religious at the time that he was finding. He was sent around by his superiors to work on reforming the religious houses and even lay people. Mostly the religious, so in turn they could, in their pastoral work, take care of the laity. And this particular priest, this saint, he would walk in, and after a day of observing in a religious house and ones around him, he would start out his first sermon to them talking about the disease that they have. Huh? Pay attention. We've got a disease. Yeah, there's a disease that's called Achidia. Wow! We've got this really weird, wild disease here. That explains why things just aren't going right around here. That explains why I just can't get anything done. I've got a disease. And he said, now, Achidia is a disease of the soul. It's where we get lukewarm and very, very negligent, even among religious. Achidia, he called it. And once he identified it and all that, then people started to fight against it because it was like the biggest disease that hit. And the main thing, he said, this is one of those diseases that seems to only hit religious and religious people. Boy, it must be something in monasteries. It must be something. It must be in the habit. It must be something like that. No, it's not. They can get so lax in living their life for God and not get up each day to work and to pray and do all these things with talents God has given them, that bit by bit they become lukewarm and negligent And so he identified as this particular disease of soul, not of body, of soul, that has to be overcome. The malice of sloth starts with this point that we have to consider. God made you and I to work and to labor. What happened when Adam and Eve had to leave the Garden of Paradise? He told them, you will have to work by the sweat of your brow for food and whatever else you need for your sustenance. You're going to have to work. And it had always been understood by the Jewish people that labor was imposed upon all of God's children as a means of penance for sin. And so labor had to be done well and for God. But then Christ came in the New Testament. And we see him working. We see him laboring. He's not working and laboring to make up for his sins, nor necessarily at that time was he making laboring to make up for your sins and mine. But he was laboring because he had physical talents that his Father gave him, and he needed to use them well. So rather than do them in a penitential idea with somebody that makes it just a ball and chain around themselves, oh, I've got to work, I've nothing about it, it's penance and all this kind of hardship. If they imitate Jesus Christ, he labored, he worked hard. You have to imagine he did. But it did because in his human person, God gave him talents. And he wanted to show the best return back to his Father in heaven for these talents that were given. So he worked well. This is what we find in what labor is. And this is where people miss the boat when it comes to the point of sloth. From creation, we've been required by God to labor. Both penitentially, if it's too hard, too cold, this, that, whatever. Don't want to get out of bed in the morning. Or also every talent to do it perfectly. That's a challenge in today's working world. To get people, even good Christian people, to do their jobs, not in a sloppy manner, but do it for the love of God, using the talents that he has given and doing it well. That's so often missed by people. And that's the reason why work becomes such a burden to them, a source of many temptations, and can even endanger a person's salvation because they have that wrong concept toward labor. Spiritual writers say that the remedies that we have in order to overcome sloth in our life, first of all, to stir up our soul and recognize that work is necessary. We don't pawn the work off on somebody else. We don't say, I do just this, and that's good enough. That language is supposed to be out of our vocabulary. Maybe a few rare occasions we could use it. But in general, it's out of our vocabulary if we're laboring correctly. God created us to work. That's our realization. Keep focusing on that. We have a careful fulfillment of the duties that we have according to our state in life. Husband, father, children, any other job that you've got, these are duties of state of life. Careful to fulfill them all. Run away from procrastination. Procrastination. Putting things off. That's the habit of a slothful person. I can do it tomorrow. I can do it tomorrow. I'll have time later, and so forth. Not necessarily. No, not really. And it's that procrastination that builds up slothful attitudes to the point we don't take the thing seriously like we should. One good remedy, and it's part of the spiritual life because sloth affects our spiritual life too as well. We don't pray like we should. We don't have a rule of life. This is, if I know I'm a weak person, that I'm slothful, that I'm lazy, and I want to start to overcome it, here's one of the first things you do. Get a rule of life, which means during the day, this is kind of like my schedule. This is what I will do. Granted, we will not always keep it perfectly, but at least there's something there in general. Prayers in the morning. I'll do this during the day and say a few prayers to God from mind and heart as I'm working. Break for, at prayer and at noontime with a meal and thanking God and for the meal and then thanking him afterwards and go back through the day, laboring for the talents that God has given to us, reparation for sin, all the way through coming back at night. Maybe we have, to rest or to have some spare time or whatever. We need to prepare a meal, do it well. Take care of everything that it should be done. Evening prayers, reading, whatever, other things that we can do that help us increase in our intellectual life, our spiritual life, those type of things. Even recreation too, those type of things. And we can't, the bowl that is always bent will surely break, is from the Book of Wisdom. So that means we can't always labor and not have a point of recreation. No, we need to. But it's just the spirit in which we have it. And along with that comes the idea of a spiritual director. Someone helps me in my spiritual life and points out to me either danger signs or encourages me along this particular path. One particular thing about spiritual directors, I have a lot of people that say, I've heard over the years of my life as a priest, Father, I want a spiritual director. Father, I want to have a spiritual director. Things like this. Can you help me with these things? So you start to help, and pretty soon they think, Father, you're interfering with my life. I don't want that. No, it's not there. Well, you came to me asking for help. And this is what I do to help you. It's like those job coaches, or you see people that go in where there's, and they have TV programs out of people that are hoarding things and whatever. No, don't throw that away. No, I don't give it. No, not that. And that's how it is going to happen in one's spiritual life. You get down into your own little petty things you're just so used to and can't think. Can't think of another way of doing it another way, because I've always done it this way, Father. Well, maybe by breaking that pattern, it's going to help you to rise up. And then also a good remedy is frequent prayer for prompt fulfillment of duties and obedience to inspirations that come from God. Promptness, right away. I don't mean by that, if I get this inspiration from God, that I should go to prayer. I'm in the middle of working, at some particular point. They go, oh, I just got the inspiration, I should go pray. Drop everything, go run, kneel down and pray. Now, your first duty is to take care of the job, the work that has to be done. But when you have the time to pray, then do so. That's what that inspiration is for. Signs of progress in the area of against sloth are, first of all, prompt performance of duties. Promptness again. Secondly, do not omit duties. Get into a habit. We know I need to do these things and build up the habit. 5, 6, 7 days come up and I'm doing really good. Then something comes into the mix and kind of takes away that schedule that's there from it. The invitation of Christ says, if I'm doing my prayers or my work for God and I get interrupted in my daily schedule because of these things, but I'm doing them for God, I can be interrupted with no loss to my spiritual life because I will so easily go back to it. But if I get interrupted because of laziness, or I just don't want to do that, then pretty soon procrastination sets in and we put it off and put it off. And the whole plan, the good success that was going, is all disappearing. Someone's making good progress in the area against sloth when they are not complacent about their spiritual progress. They know this spiritual life is so important for them to live as a child of God in every way and just say, oh, well, I'll get there. When Lent's over, I'm going to do these things. And then another feast day, I'll do it at this particular point. No, we're not going to be complacent. We're not just going to let it go off to the side. It's something every day we'll set our minds and hearts to so we can live for God. That overcomes this slothfulness of attitude and will, and helps us to live for God better and better in every way. So this brings us to the end of our considerations of the capital sins that we've done through Lent. Hopefully, like I said on Sunday about the Ten Commandments and the commandments of God and of the Church, that they've been an aid to you during Lent, spiritually to help you make progress, to overcome sin and vice. But with the capital sins, there was another thing to it. We wanted to be able to prevent a relapse into sin. It's one thing to say, the commandments are teaching me I've fallen into these sins and I just wasn't careful enough. What can I do now to be strong so I don't fall back into them? That's being careful. That's the area of our study of the capital sins. If we review the motives in our hearts that come up every time we sin, that motive is there. We're going to review it and just say, I'm not going to fall into it because I'm learning more about myself right now. And myself, well, I've got these weaknesses and I need to overcome them. So here we are at the last 3 days of Lent. The sacred Triduum starts tomorrow. Everything of our consideration of Lent should bring us to this point. The conversion of heart and soul we're working for is for here. A celebration of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and the Easter Vigil that culminates in the renewal of our baptismal promises. All of Lent has been, I hope for you, this working of conversion of heart as a goal. So these 3 days mean something. And when I stand in the church before the Easter Vigil Mass takes place and I celebrate the resurrection of Christ, I stand and I say, I do believe in God. I do renounce Satan. And I'm proud of that fact, that I'm renewing my baptismal promises because I want to live them better now than I've done so before. All of these considerations of Lent, all the graces that have come to us during this time, all focus back to that point. I don't want to take away from the reflections we have on the death of Jesus Christ and his sins for us, the institution of the Holy Eucharist and so many other things like that, but it's just, there's a reason why the Church puts the renewal of baptismal promises as the very last thing that we accomplish during the Lenten season before Easter Sunday begins at midnight. So that having spent Lent well, that's part of the preamble that takes place before we renew our baptismal promises. Having spent Lent well and overcome ourselves, now we're ready. And the question is asked, do you renounce Satan? I do renounce him and all his works and all his pomps. I do renounce them. Do you believe in God, the Father Almighty? I do believe. These aren't just words coming out of my mouth. I do believe. I really mean it with every fiber of my being. Having spent a good Lent, our baptismal promises will have great meaning to us this year, and they'll help us to keep them well every day so we can be the child of God that we know we should be. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost.